From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana. State of Belief airs every weekend on radio stations nationwide, and it's available as a podcast on iTunes and other leading podcast platforms. I hope you will subscribe to it today. I think you'll be glad you did. This program is made possible in great part by the generous support of our listeners. If you've made a donation this week, please let me say a very sincere thank you. If you haven't pitched in yet, information on how you can help keep this show on the air is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Now, here's what's coming up this week on State of Belief Radio.
The suspect in today's mass shooting at the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh had an extensive anti-Semitic, anti-Jewish digital footprint.
It was an unthinkable tragedy. On a quiet Saturday morning, the largest massacre of American Jews in history shattered the Tree of Life community in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. It was a terrifying, savage, and divisive act. But the immediate response of the synagogue's Muslim neighbors was inspiring and instructive. The Islamic Center of Pittsburgh led the campaign to help, and the executive director of that center, Wasi Muhammad, will be with us later on this week's State of Belief Radio.
My coffee would not be possible without hundreds of people I take for granted. So I would thank the trucker who drove the coffee beans to the coffee shop. But he couldn't have done his job without the road. So I would thank the people who paved the road. And then I would thank the people who made the asphalt for the pavement.
In an age of anger and frustration, what if we took a little time to remember what we already have? Research shows that people who manage to practice gratitude are significantly happier, regardless of their particular life circumstances. Taking this idea to an extreme has resulted in the fascinating new book, Thanks a Thousand, a gratitude journey. With Thanksgiving just days away, the timing couldn't be better for us to welcome the author, A.J. Jacobs, back to our show later in this hour. But first,
well, the FBI says hate crimes are on the rise nationwide. According to a new report, it is up 17%, with 80% of hate crime victims targeted because of race, ethnicity, or religion.
It was disheartening, if not surprising, to see FBI statistics come out this week that confirm what most of us have been seeing happen week after week. Hate crimes are up in this country, way up. An articulate analysis of the report and the America in which it was released appeared at Religion News Service, courtesy of Dr. Simranjeet Singh's Articles of Faith column. It raised a number of important questions facing us today, and I am so pleased to have the author join us on State of Belief Radio. Simran, welcome.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Would you mind just starting with the key statistics in the new FBI report that are so concerning?
Sure. I mean, I think one of the things that really strikes anyone who reads it is that hate crimes are up for the third year in a row now. And this year, this past year in 2017, the data is showing a 17% rise from 2016. And that's the second highest increase we've had since the FBI started tracking hate crimes. So that's concerning when it comes to religion in particular. That's also on the rise, about 23% from the previous year. Anti-Jewish hate crimes surged 37%. Anti-Muslim hate crimes are still at a historic high above national averages. And with the Sikh community in particular, hate crimes against Sikhs increased over 243% from 2016 to 2017.
My gosh. these numbers, as high as they are, may actually still be lower than reality is. I know when we were working on hate crime legislation, there was so much problem getting people to report hate crimes. So is it fair to say the numbers may be even higher than what you said?
That's right. I think, you know, one of my main concerns, and those who work in civil rights spaces have been banging on this drum for quite a while, that hate crimes are vastly underreported for multiple reasons, and I can name just a few of them for you. One is the FBI data represents what is reported federally, but there is no law that mandates authorities to report federally. And in this case, we had about 12% reporting from those who actually participate in the hate crime reporting program. So even those who belong and buy into the federal hate crime reporting system, we only have a fraction of that is represented here in the statistics. So there are a few cases that made national news, including the murder of Heather Heyer in Charlottesville, clearly inspired by hate, clearly a hate crime, but not represented in the data here. Yeah. So if a case like that is missing in this report, then what else is falling through the cracks? I think that's an important question to ask.
Yeah.
The other point that I think is important to consider is that one of the things I've experienced in my work with our civil rights organization, and this has been confirmed by other folks, both who work in the space and by people who have been victimized by hate, is that there are many reasons why people who experience hate do not report it when it happens to them. And that includes, you know, a fear of what authorities might do, an unstable or unclear immigration situation, a mistrust of law enforcement. There are cultural reasons for that, depending on people's backgrounds and where they come from. And so all sorts of reasons that we see over and over again. And here's a striking example that's somewhat embarrassing to confess. I myself, who work on this as a scholar, who work with a civil rights organization, I have not reported the hate incidents that I've experienced every time, in part because I didn't feel like it was going to yield the results that I wanted, in part because there are too many hurdles to go through and it just takes a lot of time. And so I completely empathize with those who don't report. But what that also tells us is our system needs fixing so that our reporting and our statistics and our understanding actually gets better.
Mm. Are the bulging numbers on hate crimes having more impact on some groups than others, particularly racial minorities, religious groups, or people identified as LGBTQ?
Absolutely. I mean, one of the things that stands out in the report is nearly every category identified in the statistics as an identity group, nearly every category has experienced a surge in hate over the last year, and particularly over the last 3 years. And so my work primarily looks at the experience of religious minorities in this country, but it's also true on the lines of ethnic identity, sexual orientation. We're seeing a rise there as well. And so, yes, absolutely, the spike that we're seeing is across the board for different groups with different sorts of identities.
You are a senior religion fellow with the Sikh Coalition. That organization, along with many allies, worked diligently to persuade the FBI to identify Sikhs in hate crime data. That finally happened in 2013. What are your thoughts on having gotten that done and now watching overall hate crime numbers soar nationwide?
Well, it's bittersweet, right? It's sweet in the sense that it is absolutely progress. And I believe, and our organization believes, that the more clear of an understanding we can have about what hate looks like in this country, the better job we can do to address it. And so identifying who is being targeted and on what basis and what impact it's having is critical for us as a community and as a country to move forward. I'm grateful that we got it done at a time just before this massive spike in hate crimes, because it actually gives us data that we've never had before about what hate looks like, not just for Sikhs who had never been represented, but other groups who are targeted in hate, but have sort of been erased by the system and never accounted for. Mm-hmm. So I think that's the positive. On the other hand, yes, absolutely, it's painful to see the numbers surge. And in many ways, you know, you work as hard as you can to confront the hate, to help minimize it in our communities and feel helpless that no matter how hard you're working and what measures you put into place, there's only so much you can do to mitigate the nastiness that's out there. And so that's, for me personally, that's the hardest part. And then the last piece, of course, is, as with any sort of legislation and policy, it's nice to see progress, but as I've sort of described before, our system for understanding hate in this country is broken, and we have a long ways to go before we actually get a clear understanding of what we need to know.
In your RNS column, you discuss the cultural and political trends that you think contribute to the spike in hate crimes. Some analysts see this as having been a long time coming, while others blame the current administration. Where do you come down on that?
Oh, you know, I think both can be true. Absolutely. Hate is not a new phenomenon in America. It's been here since the foundation of the country. Different groups have been marginalized and alienated and isolated and attacked. And so it's something that we've seen over and over again in different cycles. And so absolutely, it's been a long time coming, and it's been there. It's been underneath the surface. And those who experience the hate growing up, like I did in my community, you know, we're not surprised by it. At the same time, as someone who experiences this personally and works on it, yes, there is a direct relationship between the emergence of and the rise of Donald Trump and this administration and the hate we see out there. And I think, you know, I don't think I'm saying anything new or profound when I say that his language, his rhetoric, his policies, they embolden folks who have these feelings. They legitimize white supremacy and racism, and that directly translates into what we see in our daily lives around the country. And that has, you know, that can manifest itself as hate speech or hate crime or anything in between. And I'm seeing that increase on a personal level among my family and friends at our organization, the Sikh Coalition. We now, since 2015, one hate crime incident intake every single month since 2015 on average. Yeah. I mean, that's a historic high. And so it's hard for me to say anything other than there's a direct relationship in this rise, between this rise of hate and the ascendance of Donald Trump.
Do you see work being done that can turn this around? And how bad do you think things could get if we don't turn it around?
I do see work happening to turn this around. There are individuals and organizations around the country who have literally dedicated their lives to this cause, to the cause of ending hate. And a big difference is when those who fuel the flames of this hate are in power and are constantly pushing the buttons to increase the hate, then it requires a lot more momentum and a lot more energy to turn things around. Mm-hmm. Now, where I have hope is, you know, I'm a historian, and as we've seen in the history of the world, these sorts of phenomena, they cycle. And my sense is we're in a downward trend. And it will take immense energy and focus to turn things back around and move us towards progress. But I think it'll happen in part because I work closely with good people around the country who are very committed to this, and that's exactly what we need to change things right now.
Why is the number on the hate crimes against Sikhs so high?
The overall number of hate crimes against Sikhs, it's relatively lower than we see with other religious minorities. In 2017, it was 24 hate incidents against Sikhs. The percentage increase is astounding. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, there are a couple things I would ascribe to that. One is it has to do with better mechanisms that we've developed in order to track hate. You know, in 2016, we had 6 hate crimes against Sikhs reported. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't mean that there were only 6 hate crimes. I mean, absolutely, there were more. But one aspect is we have gotten better as an organization, as a community, to tracking hate. So that's true. I think the other aspect, and this is something we're very concerned about as a community, is as hate and bigotry have become increasingly normalized and increasingly acceptable, more people feel emboldened to target Sikhs and other minorities, right? Sikhs happen to be a particularly vulnerable target because of their visible identity, right? Mm-hmm. Like,
yes,
you see me on a street and I'm not just a person of color. I have a turban and a beard.
Right.
And people easily distinguish me as what they would perceive to be the enemy. And so it's far more likely that you would attack someone who looks like me simply because of those markers would trigger that sort of negative feeling in you if you have animus towards foreigners or immigrants or anyone who seems other to you. And so those are my two basic explanations as to why we're seeing this increase.
When we talk about trying to lessen the number of hate crimes, I think about the teachings in the Sikh faith that drive engagement and concern around discrimination and bias in society. And I wish you'd just talk for just a minute about the mandate in the Sikh community related to what we're talking about, because everybody can benefit from what the Sikhs talk about.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I have a 2.5-year-old daughter, and this is what I've been teaching her, that, and it's a very simple concept, that we believe God is within every single person, and if you want to respect God, then you respect all people. And, you know, the differences that we all hold are just beautiful aspects of God. And so there's no difference between myself or anyone else you would encounter on the street, because we're all divine. That's the Sikh mandate, and that's what I'm teaching to my daughter these days.
Dr. Simranjeet Singh is a writer, activist, a scholar who is a visiting scholar at New York University's Center for Religion and Media, as well as a senior religion fellow at the Sikh Coalition. His Religion News Service Articles of Faith column is headlined, FBI's New Hate Crime Report Captures an America Changed by Hate, and we'll link to it from stateofbelief.com. Simran, thank you for the clarity with which you have dealt with this dark news, and I thank you so much for taking time to be with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Of course. Thank you for having me. Really appreciate it.
There's lots more still to come on this week's show. I'll talk with the leader of the Pittsburgh Islamic Center, which stepped up so publicly in the aftermath of the Tree of Life mass shooting. And up next, A.J. Jacobs. His new book is Thanks a Thousand, A Gratitude Journey. I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, brought to you by Interfaith Alliance. A.J. Jacobs is an author and adventurer who has devoted decades to a series of lifestyle experiments that have led to best-selling books and popular TED Talks. A.J. was on our show back in 2007 when he published a fascinating book titled The Year of Living Biblically, One Man's Humble Quest to Follow the Bible as Literally as Possible. That was a great book filled with humor and with some very serious insights. There were other provocative books before that, including The Two Kings, Elvis and Jesus, And more recent titles have included Drop Dead Healthy, One Man's Humble Quest for Bodily Perfection. New and perfect for the season comes AJ's latest called Thanks a Thousand, A Gratitude Journey. And I, for one, am grateful that it brings the author back to State of Belief Radio. AJ Jacobs, thank you for being with us again.
Oh, I am grateful to be here. I'm grateful to you. I'm grateful to your producer. Grateful to your parents for having you. The whole thing.
Are you just filled with gratitude?
I'm trying.
Well, listen, I know that it's always a little bit dangerous to ask you specifically this question, but what made you want to write this book?
Well, I had been reading about how important gratitude is for years, and it's good for mental health, good for physical health. So I started a ritual in our house where before dinner, I would say, thank you to the farmer for growing these tomatoes. Thank you to the cashier at the grocery for selling me these tomatoes. And my son, who was 10 at the time, said, you know, Dad, that's kind of lame. Because those people can't hear you. They're not here in our apartment. If you really cared, you would go and thank them in person. And I said, that is a pretty good idea. That's a good book idea. So thank you, son, for earning your supper. And that's what I set off to do. It took me months, and it took me around the world.
Well, talk to us about that a bit more, because I'm interested in the travels that you undertook and some of the people that you met with.
Well, yeah, I decided to really do this right, you've got to embrace the interconnectedness of all humanity and the 6 degrees of gratitude. So I thanked the barista who sold it to me, but also you've got the truck driver who drove the coffee beans to the store, but he couldn't have done his job without the road. So you got to thank the people who paved the road and the people who painted the yellow lines on the road so the truck didn't veer into oncoming traffic. And you realize that there are thousands of people. I could have done this for my life. This could have been my life project, but I cut it off at 1,000.
My gosh. Well, tell me who was really interesting and, hearing you say thank you, and how did they respond to it?
Well, it was very interesting because I would go and visit people in person, or I would call them on the phone, or I would email them, and it was a mixed responses. So some people were like, what's going on here? Is this a pyramid scheme? What are you trying to sell me? And I'd be like, no. But the majority, delightfully enough, were very receptive. I remember I called the woman who does pest control for the warehouse where the coffee beans are stored. And I said, I know this sounds strange, but I just want to thank you for keeping the insects out of my coffee. And she paused and said, well, that is strange, but thank you. I don't get a lot of appreciation. So this made my day. And in turn, that made my day. So it was it was lovely when it worked. The gratitude is good for both the thanker and the thankee when it's done well.
You know, I have said, AJ, for a long time that I am afraid of people who can't say thank you. And there are a lot of people that seem to have trouble saying that. And it made me wonder how difficult it was for you to make a connection with strangers with whom you were saying something that they may or may not have ever said.
Well, that's an interesting question. I mean, I sympathize with those people because it doesn't come naturally to me. I say in my brain, I've got the Larry David side, the sort of the cynical negative side, and the Mr. Rogers side, the optimistic, grateful side. And they're always at battle. And the Larry David side, I think naturally, is super strong. So I really had to force myself to say thanks. It was almost I was acting as if I were grateful. But the beauty of that, as you might know, is that once you force yourself for long enough, then your mind catches up. So the founder of Habitat for Humanity has a quote I love. He says, "It's easier to act your way into a new way of thinking than to think your way into a new way of acting." So pretending to be grateful actually works.
Huh. What was one of the most interesting responses you got from saying thank you?
Oh, well, I got all sorts of amazing responses. I mean, people were, some people would send me gifts, so it turned out to be good for that. But I would donate them in spirit of gratitude. I went down to Colombia, South America to thank the farmers who grew the beans. And at first they were a little baffled as to what I was doing, but I think they got into the spirit of it. And they told me about all of the dozens of people that they rely on for their job. You know, the machine that squashes the beans is made in Brazil, and the car they use around the farm is made all over. And that was one of the big themes that I think will resonate with you, I hope, is just this idea of interconnectedness, and it's not us versus them. We are all on the same team trying to be interdependent. And that's why I find this tribalism and extreme nationalism that we're seeing so disturbing and wrongheaded.
I want to pursue that. Like most of your work, this gratitude journey is deceptively lighthearted on the surface, but I think it then reveals a lot of important insights about the subject. AJ, when I look at the forces that are roiling our nation and our world right now, one thing that stands out is that so many people are completely focused on what they think they are entitled to or should have more of or are being cheated out of. And I'm not saying life is fair, but I think fundamentally people seem to be blind about all of their blessings and only aware of their deficits. And that creates an atmosphere of resentment and anger that we see being exploited around the world right now. If that's the case, if I'm thinking right, then could more gratitude actually solve the problems of the world?
Well, I love what you say, and I agree 100%. I think it's a tool that will help. I'm not sure it alone will solve it, but I think it is a crucially important way to look at the world, because it could fundamentally change how we interact with others. And I love what you say about that we feel there's so much entitlement. And I saw this in myself. For instance, coffee is mostly water, 99% water. So I went and I thanked the thousands of people who provide New York with water. And I couldn't believe how much effort goes into it. And even down to the people who pick up the deer poop around the reservoir so that it doesn't go in the water. But what it made me realize, reminded me, is that throughout it, this is miraculous that I can turn a knob and have clean water. And then that was not available to 99% of human history. It's still not available to billions of people around the world, including some in the United States. And when I hear the phrase, you know, look, is the glass half full or half empty? Mm-hmm. I actually think that's the wrong way to look at it. It doesn't matter how much water is in there. We should be amazed that there's clean water at all, that we can turn on a tap and fill our glass. Mm-hmm. And that kind of thinking, I think it'll make us less angry. It'll make us more optimistic and realize that we have done some amazing things as a species, and we've just got to keep solving problems. We shouldn't throw it all away and say, oh, everything's terrible. Let's get rid of the system. Let's improve the system. Let's elect people who have actually had some experience, and let's make people's lives better.
What surprised you the most in working on this book?
Well, one thing that I loved was discovering all these hidden masterpieces. Well, not even hidden. They're in plain sight. Like, for instance, the little cardboard sleeve that is on my coffee cup to keep my fingers from being burned. I had never given that much thought. But I interviewed the guy who invented it, and I loved that he had this idea, and he created this thing. It's actually got an official name. It's called the Zarf, Z-A-R-F. And there were Zarfs in ancient China made of gold and tortoiseshell, but he invented the cardboard one. So I love this idea that all around us are things we don't appreciate. Even down to the logo on, I'm looking now at these board games in my house and all the fun logos and how much work people put into those logos.
AJ, what do you want a reader of Thanks a Thousand to take away with them or to feel after they read the book?
Well, I think that we are born with a negative bias. Maybe not you. You are, I aspire to be like you. But I think many of us, like me, are born that if we hear 100 compliments and one insult, we focus on the insult. And I think that's a very troublesome way to go through life. And so this book was meant to give me and hopefully readers exercises to change the way they look at the world. Because I think it'll be a better world if we look at it more realistically and look at it, some of the great things that we can do.
I remember asking you before what you learned in writing the book on living biblically. What was the big lesson you took away from this project?
Well, there were a few. One is that there are hundreds of things that go right every day that we just take for granted. So, for instance, you know, sometimes I'll take out, I'll just spend 2 minutes of my day reminding myself what went right. Like if I press the elevator button, I'm like, it's amazing the elevator comes and I get in the elevator. It doesn't plummet to the basement and break my collarbone. So let's try. I find it a much better way to live to be aware of those things and be mindful is a sort of in vogue phrase. But I think it can change the way you live.
What's the next project that you're working on?
I agree. As part of this book, I decided to write 1,000 thank you notes to readers of my books and articles. And that has been taken handwritten, personalized. So that's actually taken way longer than I expected. But I hope next to write about what we know and how we know it, because I think that's a huge crisis right now with people and misinformation, different realities. You know, what can we agree on is what's going on in the world.
AJ Jacobs is a prolific New York Times bestselling author and adventurer who is also editor-at-large at Esquire magazine. AJ's new book is titled Thanks a Thousand, A Gratitude Journey. Timely as ever. AJ Jacobs, thank you so much for being with us today, and congratulations on this latest book. And maybe you've helped all of us in this season be ready to say thank you.
Well, thanks a thousand for saying that and for having me on your show.
It is such a painful time in our nation for those of us who treasure unity, pluralism, diversity, tolerance, and cooperation across differences. I think it is essential that we highlight stories of these values in practice, and examples of that abound. Last month in Pittsburgh, a tragedy seared the nation's soul, but also brought forth acts of empathy and love that we need to keep in mind, no matter how ugly public rhetoric becomes. The massacre at the Tree of Life Synagogue took the lives of 11 members, the deadliest attack on American Jews in history. The response of the synagogue's Muslim neighbors has been covered in the media, but I really wanted to highlight this flicker of light in the darkness in our own way, and so I am very grateful to welcome Wasi Muhammad, Executive Director of the Islamic Center of Pittsburgh, to State of Belief Radio. Wasi, thank you so much for being with us today.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
So much of multi-faith action requires patient groundwork. So would you describe the depth of the interreligious relationships that existed in Pittsburgh before this tragic shooting?
Yeah, I don't think that you can possibly have such a strong positive reaction if you didn't have that framework and groundwork beforehand. And Pittsburgh is truly Mr. Rogers' neighborhood, you know, for a lot of us, especially in the interfaith community. We had known each other. We know each other's families. We've eaten dinner at each other's houses. And when something like this happens, this tragedy isn't just for that community over there. It's part of our family. You know, like we're all one body. The aching of one part of our body is the aching of our body. So we felt that pain, and we immediately reacted like we felt that pain. And I think that wouldn't have been possible if we didn't build those bridges for so many years.
Mm-hmm. What exactly did the Islamic community there do right away, and what do you continue to do across lines of religious differences?
I mean, first thing, I think people don't realize that we mourned. You know, we felt this pain, and we were upset by it, and we were horrified. And then I was on the way to the scene to see what was happening, see what we could do. I got a phone call full of messages and phone calls and from anybody and everybody in our community asking, what can we do? Where should we go? Can we show up somewhere? Can we donate somewhere? By the time I got out, left the scene, got to a computer, I had received a message from some national organizations that they had already started doing some fundraising. So we said, let's combine efforts. And it was beautiful to see that Muslims from not even here, like we know them, you know, we have personal connections with them here. But those Muslims had none, except for the fact that our tenets, the things that our faith teaches us to do, and the fact that within our tradition, it says protect Jews and Christians. It says respond to evil with acts of goodness, respond to darkness with light. Them responding so quickly was beautiful to see. So then we raised over $240,000. We showed up to vigils and shivas and dinners and potlucks and whatever the family needed, we did. We picked up food. We talked to grieving family members. We just were trying to be there for the community as much as possible. I mean, if your mother or father gets killed, if your brother or sister gets killed, you don't ask somebody, what made you step out and act and respond, you know? And in Pittsburgh, we're a family, and families have their tensions, but I think it's a special one here. And it was just a reaction that was required when something happens to your family.
Well, see, what other faith communities joined you in this action of embrace and support?
It was more than I could count. Over 30 Christian denominations, the Catholic community, the Hindu community. I saw the Baha'i community, the Sikh community. When we called out just for in a couple hours' notice, everybody came to our immediate vigil. And by the next day, we had 4,000, I don't know, some people who showed up in person on a painfully cold and rainy day, and some people standing outside the venue, just because there is no room, and they just had speakers on, and it was beautiful. Everybody came from everywhere, and they offered any support that they could offer. And not only that, what I see is consistent effort. You know, this is not going to be a moment of solidarity. It's going to be a movement of solidarity. It shouldn't take tragedies like these to bring us together, but we were already together. But what we realized from this is that the rest of the country in such dark times needed a Pittsburgh. It needed these negative stories of this killer who, his name I don't even remember because of all the beautiful stories of the victims and their families and the response, covered all of that. You know, that darkness was gone because of all this light. We realized that the country needs that. They need a model for that. So all these faith communities have committed to meeting regularly, doing work regularly, serving the community as faith communities, just so they understand that our traditions teach us to build a better country, build a better America. And we're committed to doing that as a group now, and it's beautiful.
I would appreciate it if you would talk about what it meant to the Jewish community there to have this level of siblinghood with their Muslim neighbors. What are some of the specifics that you saw the Jewish community responding with?
It was beautiful. I mean, I didn't expect, and at one level it was great seeing the surprise and how people, you know, we're enemies in a lot of people's eyes, Muslims and Jews, and people think that we cannot get along. It's just not the case here, and it doesn't have to be the case. Our religious traditions, Abrahamic faiths are very similar in terms of values. There's no reason we couldn't coexist, and we showed that. But I was upset to see some surprise from some Jewish community members, and I think they'll never feel that again. You know, we want them to understand that we're family and know that and know that they were there for them. And I just got an outpouring of support saying that you must know, which I had no doubt, that if this were to happen to our community, they'd be there in a second. Some people said that I used to be a soldier, you know, like an IDF, and we had such, you know, hatred against the Muslim community. But, you know, in my time here, I've realized that that hatred is not so deep-rooted. You know, like sometimes people are put on different sides for political reasons, but it's never right to paint that group. Some other people said that I grew up in New York after 9/11, and I couldn't help but have anti-Muslim sentiment, and today you've helped me to get rid of that. And I knew it was wrong before, but I needed to see something. And I think it made us all realize that all of our ignorance and hatred and everything is not that deep-rooted. We can get rid of it. We just have to be together. It's hard to hate somebody you know. If you know their kids, if you know their families, you know they just want safety and security and to live the American dream. You can't hate them in this country. And we can kind of show not just the rest of the country, rest of the world, you know, like how we need to come together and live our faith tradition.
Oh, that's so well said. And that's what was going on in the Jewish community. I also want to ask you, what did it do for your members to be able to take some kind of positive step, even in the face of such a disaster?
Yeah, it's difficult. I mean, I got to say, I also got messages about, you know, how easily this could happen, you know, to our communities. And fortunately, there's a strong faith community that couldn't think of a better way, what better place to go.
Yeah.
But it is difficult. It is scary, especially with families who have kids. I don't have kids, so I don't understand that pain of not knowing how to keep your family safe when you have children. So that was difficult. So that response is complicated. We're trying to figure out how to become more safe, but in the short term, but in the long term, we have to change this direction our country's going in, the vilification and dehumanization of minority communities, the fact that our rhetoric is so negative, that we've never been so divided as a country. Just because of your political belief, people think that you're a bad person, you know, regardless of which party you're a part of, the other party just thinks that you are horrible because of it. And that's just not what our tradition teaches us, and any of these traditions teach. And we have to move towards a space that we become more accepting, more tolerant, move towards real inclusion from tolerance. And that's got to be a lifelong commitment for all of us. I think we all see the reality of that. Once you see a tragedy on TV, it's not as real. Once you have one in your own neighborhood, you cannot help but recommit yourself to changing how you live your life every day, in some small way even, to ensure that, you know, tomorrow is going to be brighter, and this darkness will have to be gone someday. So, because our kids can't grow up in it. You know, we all refuse to have that happen.
You know, what you've just done is tell us how to move from the lessons to the pragmatic ways in which those lessons can help us build better communities, and I appreciate you saying it that way. I've asked about the Jewish fellowship. I've asked about your fellowship. What happened to you, to Wasi Muhammad, during all of this?
That's, nobody's ever asked me that question so far. That's a good question. You know, it's what a mix of darkness and light. You know, I was very, very struck by what had happened. It was painful, and seeing that darkness up close that we knew existed is awful. I was not shocked when this happened. I was very upset. I was sad. I was horrified, but I was not shocked, because this has been a trend. These incidents are not new. This is larger than others, but seeing the hope was really necessary. I got to say, like, I didn't realize how much I needed that more. And I didn't realize the wisdom within our tradition, the Quran in the 44th chapter and the 34th verse, says replace darkness with light. When this evil happens, do good. and response. And now I get it. You know, seeing all these people do like such great deeds, not just our community, just all these communities just coming together, Christian denominations and Hindus and Sikhs and Jews, is just, I needed that light. You know, like, I get why you have to respond with evil with that, because like evil, when it happens, when you see it, it stains you. You know, it's like that's all there is. How could you overcome such hatred, and what can you do in the face of that? And when you see so many people respond to one person's hatred and darkness with so much goodness and light, you get that feeling back of like, you know, maybe we can actually do something. And it's ridiculous to think Pittsburgh, PA, a small city, can be the model for the world. But we legitimately think that now. And there's something within us that all just turned on and saw each other doing the work and picking up each other when we fall down. It was just so important for me personally to keep motivated, for my faith, and for the faith in our community to be that model. It was really, really important.
Wasim Muhammad is the executive director of the Islamic Center of Pittsburgh after the mass shooting at the Tree of Life Synagogue there. Pittsburgh Muslims immediately activated to offer moral and critically financial support for the survivors. This ongoing siblinghood is an invaluable source of consolation for the survivors, as well as a model for the kind of healing we desperately need as a nation. Wasim Muhammad, I can't thank you enough for taking time to speak with us. You're so articulate, and you have picked up on so much that's important. And I hope you have opportunities not only with us, but with other places to share what you've shared with us, because you're talking about a way to turn our nation around, not just about this one event as important as it is. And so I'm really grateful for you being with us on State of Belief Radio.
No, it was my pleasure. I love your show. I really, really love your message, and I appreciate how hard you all work to get it out there. So thank you. Keep it up. And if there's anything you ever need from me, the Muslim community, just you got my cell phone now.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. Your generous support of this program helps keep us on the air week after week. If you've made a donation to State of Belief Radio this week, let me say thank you on behalf of every one of our listeners. If you think there's value in what you've heard here, please make your contribution today. Please put us on your list for Giving Tuesday coming up on November 27, and keep us in mind as you plan your tax-deductible donations at the end of the year. Find more information at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Stay up to date by subscribing to the free weekly State of Belief podcast on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform. And take a moment to follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Conversations are going on there. You can join the discussions. Our producer is Ray Kirstein. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
I think it's time we stop. Children, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.